Father, surely the promise of Allah is true.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Baqarah, ayat number 269, he says, whomever he grants wisdom to whomever he wants, and whoever has been granted hikmat, faqad utiya khayran kathiran, then that person indeed has goodness in abundance. And one of the prime example of that special blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as a recipient of the hikmat and knowledge from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam al-Muttaqeen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wa salam, as somebody who had ilm al-adunni, God-gifted knowledge. And therefore it's not a surprise that he emerges the most eloquent orator with exceptional ability, where he was able to speak on any topic extempore without preparing notes or thinking about it. And this is a title. This is the status of Ali, where nobody has challenged that through the centuries. Even during our times in 1930s or 40s, there was a famous Egyptian writer by the name of Shakib Arsalan, very prominent during his time. And there is a story about him that there was a gathering where he was asked to give a talk, but before he gave his talk, he was introduced by the MC. And the way the MC glorified Shakib Arsalan, he used the term for him. He says, Shakib Arsalan is Amirul Bayan. He is the chief of Bayan, oratory. Shakib Arsalan, when he came to the podium, where the first thing he says, you know, you really have been unfair to the true Amirul Bayan, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. He says, this Amirul Bayan is exclusively only for Ali. Don't use that title for me.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Trying to do on climate change? What is it you would be trying to prevent if you were leading the United States at the conference?
Well, first of all, I think one of the dumbest statements I've ever heard in politics, in the history of politics as I know it, was Obama's statement that our number one problem is global warming, okay? When we have large groups of people that want to blow up every one of our cities, that want to destroy our country, that want to kill our people, and he's worried about global warming. I think it's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen.
Having two cars, three cars in your family and a television set in every room and living that sort of life that people live in developed countries and even in emerging economies now has a cost to it. The cost cause this climate change.
And the time is running out. Time is running out. We've got 10, as the scientists say, we have 10 years to reduce our emissions by 90%. You know, we've got to keep 80% of the fossil fuels in the ground. That's a massive shift in our ways of life.
It is going to affect the way we do everything. It is going to affect the way we transport ourselves. It's going to affect what we eat, when we eat. It's going to affect how we heat, cool our homes. It's going to affect how we build our homes. It's going to affect mostly, certainly how we produce our food. It's going to affect practically every human endeavor.
If we fail in Paris, then the whole world is looking at a globally catastrophic situation, which will not spare anybody. It will hit the rich countries. New York will be affected, Berlin will be affected, London will be affected. It will affect everybody.
The average temperature on Earth has already risen by 1 degree Celsius. If we exceed 2 degrees Celsius of warming, most ecosystems will collapse. To prevent this, the United Nations has been trying to reach a global climate agreement since 1995. My film team and I are going to Paris to meet the people who are deciding about our future.
Guardians of the Earth, Part 1.
At an airport shielded by the military, over 150 heads of state make their arrival. It's the largest diplomatic gathering in history, and it's called COP21. We nearly lost our permission to film due to tightening security after the terrorist attacks Paris had suffered some weeks before. But ultimately, the UN does allow us to be among the world's leaders with our camera crew. The negotiations open in the big red plenary hall.
Distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends. Bonjour. Paris must be where the world unites as one. Paris must be where we show that we are capable of standing in solidarity with one another. Dear friends, never before has a responsibility so great been in the hands of so few.
Well, Paris is going to be my 21st COP. I've been to every single conference of parties, including this one, the 21st. Nowadays, I've become a Twitter. Whenever I come somewhere, I tweet, let people know where I am, what I'm doing. I just crossed 6,000 followers.
The river of Bangladesh is the main transport thoroughfare in Bangladesh. But sometimes they have floods and it can also be devastating.
Thank you, speakers. John Vidal, he's the environment correspondent of the Guardian newspaper in London. And in Copenhagen, on the first day of the talks in Copenhagen, he got hold of a secret Copenhagen agreement that the Danish government had prepared and published it. And that's what caused all the suspicion from the developing countries. They said, how can they have a secret agreement? They didn't tell us. And we just started negotiating.
For 21 years, these people have failed to reach an agreement that would stop climate change. We meet with Cristiana Figueres and ask her what world leaders have to do differently in Paris.
The climate change negotiation is the first time that humanity is having to answer the question, are we going to continue to work out of nation-state interests, governance, and decision boundaries? Or are we actually going to reach beyond nation-states into a global collaboration space?
On day one, the world leaders are gone. In their place, a crowd the size of a small town heads towards the conference center. 20,000 negotiators from all nations get to work on formulating the agreement's text. They're closely watched by 10,000 NGO observers and journalists. We're meeting Salim, who is a well-established COP veteran. He's well-networked with the leading figures from the developing nations behind the scenes of the talks.
We like your mobile office, sir. Stuart from Reuters.
Hi, Stuart, how are you?
Emily, how are you?
We always hear that Bangladesh is the most affected country. How does that look on the ground?
Well, Bangladesh has been known to be one of the most vulnerable countries for quite a few years now. By any measure that you might want to take, Bangladesh comes up in the first three countries of being vulnerable to floods, cyclones, even droughts on occasion. Inevitably and unfortunately, there will be millions of people, potentially more than 10 million people, who will no longer be able to continue living where they are in the coastal areas in particular.
Are you afraid of what the future of Bangladesh will look like if the deal is reached?
I'm afraid for the world. So I'm worried about how good an agreement, how ambitious an agreement are we going to have. And there's a very clear indicator between what we, and when I say we, I mean the vulnerable people and the vulnerable countries, see as good versus what we see as not good enough. If we agree a 2-degree target, which is what we have at the moment, we call that not good enough because it only protects the rich and the middle class living on the planet, and it doesn't protect the poorest. That's why we are so strong about the 1.5-degree goal. It's the right thing to do. It may be very difficult to do, but it's not impossible to do. And we want the leaders to do the right thing.
LDC chair, come.
We're following Salim to the LDCs, the group of least developed countries.
Bangladesh cannot solve the climate change problem, so Bangladesh has to have allies. The first group of allies are the least developed countries. There are nearly 50 of them. So they negotiate as a group. They try and get other groups on their side, like the other vulnerable countries. The African countries and the small island states. Whenever these three groups of countries come together and have a common position, then it's a very powerful position because they have the moral high ground. They are the countries that are going to suffer the impacts of climate change.
Please come in. Why are you scared of the LDCs? We don't bite.
Yes, people were coordinating very well between G77 as Africa,
very
as LDCs.
Yeah, very good.
So, thank you so much.
Now you are proper negotiators, you know? You guys, negotiators, hard negotiators now.
My work with the least developed country group is for the junior negotiators, we do training, teaching them how to negotiate. For the senior negotiators, it's much more strategy development. I'm like a coach. I give them mentoring and support. They have to go and play the game. They are the players. I'm not a player.
Each day, the negotiations run until around midnight. At 7 o'clock each morning, the negotiating blocks have their coordination meetings.
Developed countries do not like the word shall. Shall means the strongest obligation. They have to do it or they're supposed to do it. They prefer words like may, which gives them the option. They may or may not. They sometimes compromise with the word should. Should is less binding than shall. It is something that we urge countries to do, but countries may or may not do them. But even that is fairly weak, legally binding agreement. A global agreement is not like national law. You don't have a police force that goes and enforces people who don't abide by the law. A global agreement is still voluntary, even if they say shall.
I have no doubt that we're going to reach an agreement here next year. The next week! Woo! Next week! Okay. However, here is a concern that I hope that we all share. Is it going to be as transformative as we need? Because an agreement that only points toward gradual shifting of energy systems, of deforestation rates, of transportation, of everything else that contributes to climate change, only a gradual shift is not going to do it.
Thank you.
The COP president has called for a meeting in the Red Plenary Hall. Access is restricted. From our insider Salim, we hear that the Arab group has been attempting to sabotage the text the entire time.
Most countries are represented in the climate change negotiations by the ministries of environment. Saudi Arabia is represented by the Ministry of Petroleum. They have very good negotiators who are seconded to the Ministry of Petroleum to negotiate from Saudi Aramco. Saudi Aramco is the biggest oil producing company in the whole world. They are the ones who send negotiators from Saudi Arabia.
I have the honor of speaking on behalf of the 22 Arab countries. Mr. President, we are working in a very delicate process. We want to be guided by the proven science. When we set a goal for our efforts as governments for this agreement, it has to be substantiated with proven science, and we will all work together to achieve the scientific goal and no other goal, Mr. President, be it political or any other goals that one might think of. Mr. President, we look forward to your guidance. The Arab group is ready to engage in good faith, and we will be here to support a very successful agreement. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup. People who benefit from my system don't want to change the system. Rich countries have benefited from fossil fuels. Fossil fuel producing countries have benefited. They don't want change. They've just come out with a statement saying they want action, but that's a totally false statement. You see, they know how to play the game. They know how to say the right things, but then prevent actions from happening. And that's what one of the biggest problems that we have in the negotiation.
And one of the things we fear is that we will go into the second week with too many options on too many issues for political...
From many negotiating groups, we're hearing skeptical voices warning that the negotiations are too complex and that the task to combine all demands in a single document is simply overwhelming. Will those opposed to the agreement ultimately end up winning?
My name is Ronnie Jumo. I'm Seychelles' roving ambassador or ambassador at large for climate change and small island developing state issues. And in the absence of my president and the ministers, I'm the head of delegation for the Seychelles delegation to COP21. Islands cannot afford to wait for others. Time is a luxury we cannot afford because of the challenges we face.
When the sea level rises, people think the islands will disappear, put them in a boat, put them in Australia, problem gone. No, the problem won't be gone. Because when the islands go under, every beach in the world, to a certain extent, more or less, is going to go under. It is not going to be happen just as if it's happening on Mars.
When you talk of islands, this is what you think of, right?
It's a 4 or 5 star tourism resort. And this is what climate change is doing to it. And in Seychelles, the biggest problem we're having now is coastal erosion, short-term problem. Everywhere you go in Seychelles now, you see this. This is coastal erosion. The beach used to be over there. They've lost all that land. You can see the trees just collapsing into the ocean. I will show you an island which will eventually disappear. This is one of the atolls we will lose to sea level rise. It will go eventually.
In my youth, I actually did quite a bit of research and work in Samoa and fell in love with a beautiful island which had the most beautiful singing I have ever heard. And that contrasts quite remarkably with the Samoa that I saw last year. Samoa that is still a beautiful island, but that is in serious threat. This is real human pain. I don't know how people can disassociate themselves from this pain and just talk about it in a cold manner.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Question: what will the role of women be in a future Islamic government? Imam replies, women are free to participate in many affairs, free in the true sense of the word, not in the sense that the Shah wanted. Some of our women are in prison, and of those who are not, a great number take part in the demonstrations and the struggles. An insignificant number are free, free in the sense that the Shah wants them to be free. We are most definitely opposed to that kind of freedom. January 15th, 1979.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi. Today we're going to talk about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the women's role in the society. In one of the speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that the woman is the only being that can deliver individuals to the society, by whose blessings the society, nay, the entire societies, are drawn to endurance and lofty human values. Now, in this part of speech, Imam Khomeini is clearly talking about the status of a woman. And he says that it is only the woman, through her existence, we can have the individuals. That's the first thing. Now, these individuals were coming to the societies because they become leaders. They become good people. They are the ones who are educating people. Now, all these things that we have in the society, or this blessing that we have in the societies, it lifts the societies, it takes societies to a higher level. And this cannot be achieved if the woman is not in the society, if we do not respect women. Therefore, it is necessary to give respect to the women. It is necessary. Why? Because Islam also emphasizes on the respect of women. The way Islam has given the respect to the woman, no other religion or society has given it.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.
In Islam, it is said that the heavens are under the feet of mothers. What does it mean? It means that if the children will respect their mother, they will go to heaven. If they disrespect the mothers, they cannot reach heavens, even if the mother is a non-believer. It is ordered to respect her because Allah has put heavens under the feet of mother. It means you need to respect her. You cannot pay back mother even for a single movement when she had you in her womb. You cannot even pay back a single movement for a single movement. And do not think about paying back for what she has done for the whole life. This is the Islamic ideology about a woman. This is what Islam talks. And this is what Imam Khomeini is also saying, that this is a woman, because of which we can see in the entire societies that they are drawn to the endurance and lofty human values. These values today which we see, these are because of the woman, the existence of the woman. If we do not have this woman in the society, then obviously we wouldn't benefit from these human values.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. In California, United States, dozens of freight cars are broken into every day on Los Angeles railways by thieves who take advantage of the train stops to loot packages bought online, leaving thousands of gutted boxes and products that will never reach their destinations. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at Agence France-Presse. The piece is titled "Thieves Loot Freight Trains in Los Angeles with Impunity." Stay with us for more. According to the tags found on Friday by an Agence France-Presse team on a track near the city center in Los Angeles, which was easily accessible from nearby streets, many major U.S. mail order and courier companies, such as Amazon, Target, UPS, and FedEx, are being hit by the thefts, which have exploded in recent months. The thieves wait until the long freight trains are immobilized on the tracks, and then climb onto the freight containers, whose locks they easily break with the help of bolt cutters. They then help themselves to all sorts of parcels, ditching any products that are difficult to move or resell, or are too cheap, such as COVID-19 test kits, furniture, or medications. Rail operator Union Pacific has seen a 160% rise in the thefts in Los Angeles County since December of 2020. In October of 2021 alone, the increase was 356% compared to October of 2020. Union Pacific said in a letter to the local authorities, seen by Agence France-Presse. The explosion in looting has been accompanied by an upsurge in assaults and armed robberies of Union Pacific employees performing their duties moving trains, the letter said. The phenomenon spiked recently with a peak of activity linked to Christmas shopping. According to figures reported by Union Pacific, more than 90 containers were vandalized every day on average in Los Angeles County in the last quarter of 2021. To combat the trend, Union Pacific says it has strengthened surveillance measures, including drones and other detection systems, and recruited more security staff for its tracks and convoys. Meanwhile, police and security agents have arrested more than 100 people in the last 3 months of 2021 for trespassing and vandalizing Union Pacific trains. While criminals are being caught and arrested, charges are reduced to a misdemeanor or petty offense, and the person is back on the streets in less than 24 hours after paying a nominal fine, said a spokesman for the rail operator. In fact, criminals boast to our police officers that there is no consequence for them, he said. Union Pacific wrote to the Los Angeles County Attorney's Office at the end of December, asking them to reconsider a leniency policy introduced at the end of 2020 for such offenses. The operator estimates that damages from such thefts in 2021 amounted to some $5 million. Adding that the amount in claims and losses does not include respective losses to our impacted customers or to the impact on Union Pacific's operations and the entire Los Angeles County supply chain. A spate of flash mob robberies at high-end stores in and around the San Francisco Bay Area, the city of Los Angeles, Chicago, Illinois, and various other cities throughout the United States have made headlines in recent weeks. Tens of thousands of dollars worth of jewelry, sunglasses, clothes, and other merchandise have been stolen in these brazen robberies. Law enforcement officials believe the thefts are the work of organized crime networks, recruiting young people to steal valuable merchandise and then sell it online. We're not talking about someone who needs money or needs food. These are people who go out and do this for high profit and for the thrill, said Ben Duggan, president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail. The people recruited to perform the thefts are paid $500 to $1,000 to take as much merchandise as they can or steal specific items and bring it to certain people who then send it to other parts of the country to be resold, the Associated Press has reported. The so-called criminal flash mobs are a growing trend designed to look chaotic, but law enforcement officials say they're quite the opposite and can also hide in and around other events. During the protests across the United States and in San Francisco area in the summer of 2020, following the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, Ben Duggan, the president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail, said during the protests across the United States and in San Francisco, California, in the summer of 2020, following the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, similar thievery took place in multiple U.S. cities. Ben Duggan added, "It was meant to look like looting, but it really wasn't. It's a criminal entity employing other people to steal for them so they can profit by selling it online."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules related to prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the rules about prayer according to Ayatollah Khomeini. Is it permissible to pray with a dress made of leather, but you don't know whether the leather is artificial, synthetic, or natural?
Of course, according to all religious authorities, it is permissible to pray with it, because that leather, which is apparently leather, a leather product, it may be synthetic, it may be unreal, and it may be real, okay?
Yes.
In that case, it is permissible to pray with it. You can wear the coat that is made of such leather, the leather which you are not sure whether it's real leather or artificial leather.
Mm-hmm.
So your prayer is, the prayer will be valid.
Mm-hmm. If a person, Sheikh Javid, is wearing a gold ring or watch,
yeah,
and he hides it from other people, is it or it's obviously haram for him to wear it, but does it affect his prayers?
Wearing gold ornaments or anything that contains gold, like a wristwatch, for example, is forbidden.
Yes.
Whether you hide it from other people, whether you mean to wear it with the intention of beautification or as an ornament, or if you do not have this purpose, if you put that watch in your pocket, again, it's not permissible to wear that, to keep it in your pocket and offer your prayers with it. So you have to remove it, and it is forbidden to wear anything made of gold, regardless of whether you pray or you do not pray, because wearing gold ornaments is forbidden under all circumstances. It is haram for a man to wear gold ornaments, no matter what the situation, whether he's praying or not praying. It's haram for him to wear anything made of gold.
Obviously, you mean the gold as we know of it,
yeah,
right?
Gold, of course.
Not the white gold, the platinum.
No, of course, platinum is not haram. It is not gold in common view.
Mm-hmm.
It's not considered to be gold.
But what if, Sheikh Javid, somebody wears them, all right, and what is the Islamic law about it, that the man doesn't know or forgets that is wearing a ring, for example, made of gold,
yeah,
while praying? So does that affect his prayer? Is his prayer valid?
According to ruling 93 of the book authored by the Supreme Leader, he states that it is, in that case, his prayer is valid,
mm-hmm,
okay? Because he forgot that his, for example, ring was made of gold, and then he went on praying with it, and after completing the prayer, he learned that, okay, he should have taken off the ring, or he should, yeah, or there was gold ring in his pocket. So in that case, Supreme Leader says that his prayer is valid.
I see. Okay, another question, Sheikh Javid, would be that we know that you said in one of the earlier episodes, as one of the conditions, that the fabric or the material of the clothes or the dress should not be made of silk for men.
Yeah.
It's forbidden, actually.
Silk,
all right?
Is forbidden, yes.
For their prayers. Well, if a man wears a dress made of pure silk, okay, the prayer is void, as you said.
Yeah.
But if you wear socks made of silk, does it affect your period?
You know, tiny things, like if you have a handkerchief,
yes,
in your pocket, of course, it will not affect your prayer. And let's not forget that when we talk of silk, we mean pure silk, okay? For example, if you're wearing a shirt which is not made of pure silk, you know, there is that shirt is made 90% of the shirt is made of silk, and 10% is not silk. It may be of some other things,
yes,
you know,
cotton, wool,
cotton, whatever. Yeah, that's not considered to be pure silk.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, it's permissible to wear that dress and pray. But things like, for example, you know, a handkerchief,
mm-hmm,
is, you know, exempted. But Ayatollah Khamenei expressly states that, okay, socks and things like that must not be worn during prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Socks. Even though socks are not big things, you know, but since you wear them, it's made of pure, if they are made of pure silk, you cannot pray with him, and your prayer will be affected. But if you have a small piece of kerchief in your pocket, it does not affect, even if it's made of pure silk.
I see. But obviously, you're talking about natural silk when you say pure
silk. Right.
Pure silk, but not artificial silk, because you also have artificial silk, you know?
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yes, maybe. Yeah, we obviously mean natural silk. Pure silk means natural silk.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest speaker here in the studio, talking about the rules about prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. What about the lining of a dress? If it is made of pure silk, will it make the prayer void, Sheikh Javid?
Well, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei clearly states that it doesn't make any difference whether the dress worn by a man or a woman is you know, has a lining or not. If it does have lining, then it shouldn't be made of silk.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make any difference whether the silk is whether your coat is made of silk or the lining is made of silk or any other clothing is made of silk. Silk is absolutely forbidden for men, and you cannot wear any clothing or anything made of pure silk, no matter what circumstances you are in, and no matter what that thing is, except for small things like a handkerchief, which is of course exempted, you know, which we can keep in our pockets.
Mm-hmm.
But the other things should not be made of pure silk.
I see. Can women, Sheikh Javid, wear clothes made of gold or pure silk?
Yes, of course, women can wear, you know, clothes made of gold and silk. Obviously, gold and silk are permissible for women, but, you know, there's one thing we need to note, and we need to understand that women cannot wear gold ornaments in places where they are seen by non-mahram men, because they are ornaments and they are worn by women for beautification, for adornment, for, you know, and they wear gold ornaments to make themselves look beautiful in the eye of the of people around them. So it's not permissible for women to wear gold ornaments, gold items, for beautification in places where they are likely to be seen by men. You know, in places where they are very much likely to be seen by men. If they are sure there are men around them, they cannot wear those gold ornaments. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely forbidden for women to wear gold ornaments in places where they are seen by men. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it's permissible for women to wear clothes and dresses made of pure silk.
Yes, Sheikh Javi. We don't have much time, but I have a little question or a small question here. In the case of, you know, now we all know that COVID-19 is a household term or image that lots of people see that often, you know, and we know that there is the health department and the nurses and doctors who are really working hard, in fact, to guard people against this virus. And sometimes it happens that these nurses are Muslims in non-Muslim countries, and they have to perform the prayer while wearing their uniform. And their uniform is usually white, as we all know it.
Yes.
And they are all the time working with the patients, and some of them, in fact, some of their clothes become stained with blood.
Blood.
So what can they do? They can't afford, in fact, to change their clothes and go to somewhere safer and offer the prayer. So what can they do in that case?
Well, you know, the ruling is clear. It's not permissible to wear the dress.
Mm-hmm.
The dress stained with blood,
yes,
is not permissible to wear. And of course, as a nurse, they have the time and maybe the water available, and they can wash the clothes stained with blood, they can purify themselves, and then offer their prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that the prayer they offer is valid.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, if you wear your a cloth stained with blood, you know, you cannot wear it during prayers. And if the space covered by blood is bigger than the size of,
yes,
a thumb, then obviously the prayer is not going to be valid, and the cloth must be washed.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alim La ilaha illa hum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.